which has been, my understanding, is currently under audit. There are compliance responsibilities, and the IRS is apparently auditing. But those obligations remain regardless if it's one vendor or 10 or 15.
Other questions?
I'm trying to, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bryant. Senator Byer.
Just following up on Senator Bryant, the responsibilities are what? Do they have to keep books on where the money goes? I assume that's just part of a normal payroll record.
A 403B is a tax-qualified vehicle. 403B makes reference to the IRS code.
Mm-hmm.
And if a teacher is setting aside too much money, or a school district employee is setting aside too much money, more than the 20% they are allowed, then the IRS is not getting its fair share. And at some point, the IRS, for some reason, would raise a concern.
That's just a decision that a school district makes up front, or an employer, in terms of whether they're going to participate in that kind of a program. What you're saying is if they choose to participate, then you can't close the number of vendors that the employees might utilize.
That's what I'm suggesting. That's what the bill suggests.
Am I correct in assuming that the district would have had to make a decision first whether they're going to allow their employees to participate?
It's my understanding that the law allows them, requires that they be allowed to participate now. But what the North Clackamas School District did was close the requirement and say, everybody can participate, but you can only participate with one vendor.
Ms. Brown.
With the tax IRS difficulties, with the burden, with the grant beyond the school district as opposed to the employee?
Indeed.
Okay.
That's my understanding. I am not a
tax expert. Occurs now, assuming that they have these in place.
That occurs now.
Okay.
in any unit using a 403B.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. I did want to add that I intentionally kept my list short today because I know you're cramped for time.
I appreciate that.
The folks.
I appreciate that, and you stay available. You may have further questions after we have further testimony.
I'll be happy to.
But we'd invite
Al Shannon, Marilyn Cribbs, Wayne.
I can't see that.
Exactly.
Couldn't see that second letter.
Sorry about that.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Al Shannon, and I'm an employee of the Oregon School Boards Association. I'm also representing the Oregon School Business Officials today at the committee meeting. And I'm passing out some written testimony that I'll paraphrase and go through for you and the committee members. Although the bill is well-intentioned, I think there are problems with it for Oregon school districts. The tax shelter annuity program was set up by Congress to provide an avenue for retirement savings for school and nonprofit hospital employees. It's codified in the Internal Revenue Code under 403B, which is very similar to the 401K program that private industry has access to. And as you've heard previous testimony, the program allows employees to contribute up to $10,000 or 20% of their income, whichever is less, into this pre-tax program. It defers that until retirement, as well as the earnings on it. And frankly, it's a good way to provide supplemental retirement funds for school employees. The problems that we see with Senate Bill 913, the first one, I think Oregon school districts would lose control over the selection of the TSA companies that serve their employees. Any five employees could come to the district and say, well, upon authority of this bill, that you shall provide payroll deductions for this tax sheltered annuity company. And the district would be required to set up a payroll reduction for that, for those five employees. And then if next month one of those employees left the district, then there would be four. And that deduction would continue until the last employee either retired or left the district. It can be a cumbersome item for school districts to manage. With me today is Sam Kaiser, the payroll supervisor of Maryland Cribs, and she currently told me they have 37 companies with the Salem-Kaiser School District. The second thing that we see as a problem with Senate Bill 913 deals with the greater exposure to IRS audits. IRS is currently auditing Salem-Kaiser School District, and they're concerned with the calculation that is done on the maximum exclusion allowance, or MEA, that employees go through for their salary reduction agreements. They have found in other audits around the country that salaries have been over-reduced. Therefore, the IRS has missed out on income tax, withholding, Social Security, Medicare benefits as well. And that's what has prompted the IRS going around the country and doing the audits. When they find a problem with a TSA deduction, they will first look to the school district, as the district is the deep pocket and probably the easiest for the IRS to get to. Currently, the Salem audit is going through 1997 information, mm-hmm. And some of them employees that were deducted back then have already left the district, no doubt, and it would be difficult for the district to go back to that employee to recover that. So we feel that the district is exposing themselves to penalties which are not in their control. The districts do rely upon the TSA companies to accomplish the MEA calculation. This can be a very complicated calculation and not easily conducted. There are some companies that are doing this calculation now as a service to school districts, but in return they either want compensated for that calculation or want exclusive rights to their employees. Right now, the program is run by the federal law, and if employees would like to contribute to another TSA company that's not authorized by the school district or sponsored by the school district, they can conduct a fiduciary transfer. In other words, they can run the money through as a conduit into the accepted company, and then they can move that money out at the end of the term. So the same thing can be accomplished. It's just the paperwork for that falls upon the employee and not the school district. I'd like to make a comment also on school districts establishing policy or setting parameters for TSA companies that have access to their employees. You heard testimony earlier on the North Clackam School District, and they are required to go through competitive procurement when they enter into a public contract. It's my understanding the North Clackam School District went through the RFP process in the selection of their current carrier. And so the competitive process wasn't spurned in this. It was open to folks that were submitting proposals, and it's my understanding they did comply with that. Our biggest concern is schools would be losing local control over what companies have access to their employees. There are companies out there that don't provide the best product for employees. Some companies have a front-end load and a back-end load and can be a very expensive vehicle. We are in opposition to Senate Bill 913, and there's no vote. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Al, can you explain your point three here, the federal law? How does that work?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, a fiduciary transfer is a transfer where it's not a taxable event to the individual making the transfer. If you have an IRA, for instance, you can move that IRA between vehicles. And you just give instructions to the company you want it to give your authorization to do the transfer.
Isn't one of the advantages of a 403B that it comes out pre-tax? And just trying to understand the mechanics of how an employee, a school district employee, would get the money before they got it in their paycheck to whoever the transfer agent was.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, the way I would do it is if the school district had one company that you set up with, it says you're authorized to do business with this ABC company, and I would do a salary reduction agreement. If my salary were say, $40,000, mm-hmm. I'd do a $10,000 salary reduction, so I'm taxed on $30,000 instead of $40,000. That $10,000 goes into the company's pre-tax basis, and then and goes into an account with my name on it. And then at any time, I can do a fiduciary transfer, and I can say, move this money to this other account that I think is now a better vehicle for
it. I would think if you were doing that, and if I were the company, I would be pretty upset if I was getting, you know, a number of district employees doing that, setting up in my account, and then each month getting an order to move it to somebody else from other companies. And aren't there some transfer fees that are attached to something like that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I did one on my IRA just last month, and I was charged a $10 fee for that. Some companies do charge a fee, and other companies do not charge a fee. So I haven't reviewed each one, so it's difficult for me to provide testimony on that.
Sure. And most likely there would be, I would assume if you were doing that, if a lot of people were doing that, it wouldn't take too long before a company would set a fee up.
There are some with no fees.
There's what?
There are some with no fees. That you can do that quite easily. Sorry.
But it would depend on, if there was only one like the Clackamas example, it would depend on whether the company that the district chose allowed that.
Is that a big thing?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm Wayne Stackley, and I'm actually the consultant that worked on North Clackamas School District, and so I can maybe answer some of those questions. We were approached in the RFP process by North Clackamas, and I apologize. Bill Deardorff, who is the business manager at North Clackamas, would be here. He's recovering from complications of an appendicitis attack, and so he's not here today, otherwise he would be. To answer your question as far as a transfer mechanism, it's very easy to do if your money is contributing to XYZ mutual fund, to a money market fund. There's no fees going into that. You can then very easily transfer from one money market fund to another account.
But between the companies?
Yeah.
That's generally not a problem.
It's not a wise decision often because your money is going to be sitting out of the market when maybe you want it invested in the market. But other than that,
I was just trying to get to the point of saying that if Clackamas had one, and for whatever reason, an employee there wanted to use
something else,
American Express,
sure,
or something else, what I'm hearing you say is it would be fairly easy for them to using the established process to have that happen.
They could, and currently some are. Now I should probably clarify it. North Clackamas, what they did is they brought us in as a consultant. And had us signed us up as the vendor, but we have three different companies, two mutual funds and one variable annuity that employee contributions can go to. So it sounds very limiting all the way down to one company, where in reality it's three different separate companies that they can contribute to. And within those three companies, you've got 60-plus funds that an employee can choose between.
Further questions?
I have a couple others. One is just to be clear. Federally, are employers mandated to provide this service to an employee if they request it?
Yeah, 403B has an eligibility requirement that as soon as it's administratively feasible, it must be offered to all employees. So, for example, within 30 days, whether I'm a part-time, a full-time, whatever my status is as a school district employee, as an example, this must be made available to you.
So it's really federal law doesn't give the schools any options on that. The only options are they could choose which companies to participate with. The second piece now, am I correct in understanding it's 20% of salary up to $10,000?
The lesser of the two. There are exceptions to that depending on years of service, and there's a whole calculation on that.
That seems to be a fairly simple payroll calculation.
I'm oversimplifying the... Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's trying to the complexity of the
it's
problem.
Very complex.
Actually, it's very complex and extremely tedious to do because there are regulations that you have to, for compliance issues, there are certain criteria in order to be able to go over the 20% or $10,000. There are many things that are involved in the calculation process.
Okay. Senator Brown.
Just a couple follow-ups. Al, in your testimony, you say that the Oregon school districts will lose control over the selection of TSA companies. I mean, if Salem Kaiser already has 35 vendors, it sounds like they've already lost control and this bill won't affect them. Sure.
That's why North Clackamas hired us.
Okay.
Because they had lost control and they feared, you know, what's going to happen when we get audited. And initially, they sent out a letter to all of those carriers, and they received a minimal, dismal response back. So out of fear of, well, if these audits come, and then we request information from these vendors of which we've relied upon, are we then not going to get the response that we're going to need to comply with an audit?
So your argument, Mr. Chair, if I may, is that some school districts have already, quote, lost control. Okay.
No.
So, can I ask a follow-up? My name's probably for you then. In terms of them already experiencing exposure to IRS audits, it sounds like Salem-Keizer is, I mean, under current law, is already experiencing the exposure, and that the addition doesn't really affect your concern.
I'm not sure what the purpose of adding this language in there, other than to increase the exposure that your public schools would have. And you've got to realize that that would then translate into an exposure for the taxpayer.
Right, but Salem-Keizer already has the exposure. This bill doesn't give them any broader exposure, unless they assume they're going to have, you know, another 30.
Ms. Chair, Senator Brown, in talking with Salem-Keizer, they indicated that their threshold was 30 employees.
Okay.
And maybe I'm speaking for Marilyn, and I should let her address that question. So.
Yeah, we currently require that 30 employees be brought in before a company can be opened up.
Right. Can you ask one more question?
Yes, Senator Brown.
What would happen if the bill went the opposite direction, and that is prohibited school districts from limiting to simply one vendor?
It's your decision whether you want to take that control at the state level.
Providing 70% of the dollars.
Right, I understand. I understand. Keep in mind that right now, and this has been in place since the early 60s, that control has been at the district level. The whole reason the North Clackamas issue came up and this bill is here is because the district said we want to try to comply with the law.
Thank you.
Senator Byer.
Now, what's the experience, the trend with schools now, school districts across the state?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Byer, I think our policy section, I inquired with them, and our sample policies indicate that they should be establishing criteria, school districts should be establishing criteria for the TSA vendors. We feel this can be done best through policy, and the threshold of employees required before they join Salem was chosen 30. Other districts have chosen different numbers. We feel that's a local decision, and the school board should be really controlling that.
And let me ask Marilyn, is the driver for changes mainly the IRS getting more aggressive?
Well, actually, maybe it's easier if I kind of explain what we go through to set up a company. If a company approaches us and wants to come in and they get their 30 people, so we go in. We have to set them up in the system to make sure that they are completely compliant with what box they go into the W-2. We have to set up a balance sheet account. We have to set up a vendor account. And then each individual employee who wishes to participate in the program must then sign an authorization that allows us to make the deduction. And keeping in mind all of these criteria that the IRS has set into being as far as the rules are concerned. So once the employee has signed the authorization, we then make the deduction. The employee is able to sign that as much as once a month, or change that authorization as much as once a month. The money comes out of the paycheck, it's held in the balance sheet account, and then on a monthly basis, we make a checkout for those 37 companies and send it. So it's very complex in that we have to know what those rules and regulations are for the IRS, and then also that every time, for every company that we have another check that we have to produce. It's administratively difficult to handle. And as a payroll manager, my real main function is to accurately and timely pay all the employees of the Salem-Keizer School District and to comply and send the deductions on taxes to the IRS and the Social Security Administration. So part of that also then is to make those withholdings from the companies and to send those. But the more company vendors that I have to pay, the longer it takes me to accurately and timely pay those employees.
Comment. Al, I believe you used as an illustration $40,000 salary and a $10,000 deduction. You're going to be oversubscribed, aren't you?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
That audit.
I couldn't help that.
It looks like you needed a financial planner.
We have vet insurance and dentist Denise Hampers. On another bill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Grant and Sharon, representing the Oregon University System. With me is Denise Junker, who is the Human Resources Manager for the OUS. I'm here to answer any other questions and also to finish the testimony in the event that her voice fails.
Okay, so I'll try to begin this and hopefully I can get through this. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you about this program. A 403B program is... I'm sorry, I'm Denise Yonker, Human Resources Manager, Oregon University System. And our 403B program that we run through the university system is a valuable program that helps people save for retirement, and we're strongly supportive of that program. But what we have encountered is that this is an extremely difficult program to manage. Reflecting some of the comments that I've heard previously, we find that we have an enormous administrative overload by trying to stay in compliance with the plan because of the complexity of the plan. If you have dealt with 403B plans previously, what we are required to do is to have a maximum exclusion allowance calculated. We require our vendors to do that, or our employee participants to do that. And then we do the monitoring on the $10,000 402G limit and the 415 IRS limit. And this monitoring takes one FTE. This has been since 1992 when we expanded our program to allow vendors who had 30, not 100, but 30 participants. And we are constantly busy trying to monitor the program. As part of our due diligence in maintaining a good program, the steps that are required in putting a new vendor on require that we assure that we have $1 million of error and omission assurance. We have the contract reviewed by Department of Justice, and we also have our own legal department review the contracting, and then also we have to have a verifiable participant list. So there's an enormous amount of work in maintaining these plans. The other piece that we run into is with this maximum exclusion allowance calculation, while it is the responsibility of the employee and the vendor to calculate that correctly, if that's done incorrectly, even though we're monitoring the 402G and the 415 tax limits, there's a possibility that we could be making incorrect withholdings. And this is something that is very difficult to get in front of, particularly because of the way that the maximum exclusion allowance is calculated. That requires accumulating years of service with the institution, accounting for breaks in service, part-time service, and for the Oregon University System service at any one of the seven universities. So it's an enormously complicated manual process that we have not yet, even with a new HRIS or payroll system, been able to automate. So very, very labor intensive, and we spend an enormous amount of time managing this program to ensure that we're not inappropriately taking our tax withholdings from these accounts. So that is one of our issues. The other issue that we run into is campus solicitation. And by restricting the number of vendors that we actually have on a preferred vendor list, we're able to keep our faculty from being addressed in the workplace regularly. And this is a workplace issue that is a high priority for some reason on the OUS campuses. Obviously, we can't release employee names after the bill in the last legislative session that said public employee names and addresses are no longer public record for release, which we've done previously. So at this point, we have very limited access to employees except on the work site, and we're quite concerned about opening that up extensively. So those are some highlights of the issues that we see with the 403B program, and we would prefer to see there be a higher limit imposed than 5, if there is a limit. And I think that it should be determined by the institutions that have to actually do the management of the program. Thank you.
Senator Barr.
Thank you. Denise, I'm trying to understand this. Is part of the issue in compliance that employees may participate in more than one plan, and it's the total issue?
It is, because what happens is that we have 4 plans available through higher ed. We have 2 401A plans, the ORP, the PERS plan. They can also participate in the 403B plan, and then also in the PERS Oregon Savings Growth 457 plan. And all of these plans need to be integrated if you're working through the parameters of IRS
code. Total compensation.
Mr. Chairman, let me ask you, under the 403B, how many vendors are certified now for OUS employees? How many individual companies are vendors?
Good question. Right now, we have 18 vendors on our list. And since we went to a restricted list in 1992 with the parameters that we require, we've had 4 vendors drop off for failure to maintain 30 minimum participants, and we've added 2 new ones.
Further questions?
Mr. Chairman, let me just add for the record that I'm sorry that the bill comes before you to cure a problem in one school district, but want to underline that as the university system continues its activities in devolving financial and administrative control to campuses from the university system, allowing this to go to 5, which would be 1/6 of the limit it is today, would be administratively extraordinarily difficult, probably doubling or tripling the FTE required for this to the university system, and also keep us from continuing to decentralize our operations, because it would make it virtually impossible for the campuses to be able to take this up on their own. I can also report that my understanding is, although they're not here today, that the OHSU is also opposed to a threshold so low as to be meaningless. And they may submit a statement later.
No further questions. We thank you very much. I had no one else signed up to testify on this bill. We're under some time constraints tonight because we have a Republican caucus meeting starting at 6 o'clock. So I'm going to close our public hearing. Senate Bill 913, and we will not be opening a work session tonight on that bill. I'll be opening a public hearing on H.C.R. 6. All righty. We'll let him speak when he gets here. Don, would you come forward? And Don Hall.
What are we on? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the record, my name is John Gervais, and this is a, in this particular role, I asked or requested that Representative Menace introduce HCR 6, honoring a person that I worked for in 1972 and 73, and who was a great inspiration and a great member of the legislature. And I'm talking slowly, trying to wait for Senator Duncan to get here, because his comments embrace the heart of the concurrent resolution. I had the honor of working for State Representative Bob Elliott when he served in his 4th term in the legislature. And he was a very powerful member of the legislature, first Republican ever elected in East Multnomah County. And that was because of the, or that was in a sense due to the change in districts from 3-member districts to a single-member district. And I think I'll defer to Senator
Duncan. And then
if I may follow up with after the discussion.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Vern Duncan, Senator from District Number 12 in Clackamas County, and I'm here today in support of House Concurrent Resolution 6A, which honors former State Representative Robert A. Elliott, a longtime friend of mine, Robert A., and many people called him Bob, but if you knew his wife very well, Thelma, who was a member of the State Board, and I worked with her many years, always called him Robert A., so we refer to him as Robert A. He was a force of Oregon politics for over 50 years. And in 1952, he was the youngest state Republican Party chairman in the nation, and he was one of the five first individuals to second the nomination of Dwight Eisenhower for president in 1952. That's kind of an exciting time for him. His political career was marked by being one of the major leaders of the civil rights movement in Oregon, beginning his fight for racial fairness in the 1940s, and he was at the front fighting for other progressive issues. He served in the legislature from 1967 to 1975. In 66, he was elected to the House from the East Central District in Multnomah County. He was a leader in the areas of mass transit, child care, education, and issues protecting the less advantaged. Really a great supporter of education, both he and his wife Thelma through the years. They're just great supporters of education. He's often referred to as the father of TriMet, having passed the legislation creating the system of mass transit, presently in the Tri-County area and also in Lane County. Graduate of Grant High School, University of Oregon, served in World War II with distinction on the European battlefront. Very active in his military, and our paths crossed in those careers during the reserve activities through the years, too. He was a proud member of Grace Memorial Episcopal Church in Portland, and he was a Sunday school teacher for up into his 80s. He served his family, his friends, his church, his state, and the nation with love, vigor, and open-mindedness, and fairness, and distinction. And, frankly, during the last session, he was down the session. He brought a young man down, just a young boy. He brought him down and wanted to get the feeling of experience of government in action. He was still teaching, I guess you might say, at that stage, and loved the legislative process, and we talked about it really right up to the end. He was just a great man, and there's a great family, and I love them both, and I'm very proud to be able to here to support this resolution this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the comment. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll go into my more personal comments. I met Bob Elliott in 1972, and he and his family did become like a second family to me. He was a great teacher. I learned a great deal about politics and the legislative process from him. And he was known around here as the Silver Fox. He was a very distinguished-looking individual, very dapper dresser, and he was very smooth in getting through the process and sneaking things through occasionally. But Speaker Smith, Bob Smith, didn't, being from a more conservative part of the state, didn't necessarily approve. But I remember a lot of fond things. I remember 1973, he was in that time for the first time in a minority role, and we were on a tour of the state, I think it was the Labor Committee, traveling around trying to get public input into some of the issues of the committee in a time when we were pretending to care what the public thought about our issues in that committee. But we were put in this old hotel in Santa Falls, which is probably an oxymoron because there weren't any new ones at that time, and on the fourth floor. And as we're heading down to dinner with the committee, he said, "I'd like to find out if we can find a fire escape before we go downstairs." And I was really more interested in getting a beer. But we went up and down the hall and couldn't find anything at the end of the hallway where there was a window where the four-story dropped to the ground, and that didn't seem like the appropriate place. And there were no doors open and or marked with anything but room numbers or closets. Found one door, and he opened it very gently and walked in, and to his chagrin, there was an elderly gentleman using what was the public bathroom for the floor for those rooms that didn't have a shower or bathroom in it. He was in a tub taking a bath, and Robert A. got a little bit red-faced, and he said, "Pardon me, sir, I'm very, very sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you or embarrass you. I was just looking for the fire escape." And he closed the door, and we walked on out and down the hall looking further. We heard this clatter, bang, boom, and this guy comes running out, you know, wrapped in a towel. "Where the hell's the fire?" And a lot of experiences with with Robert A., which some of the things that I'm most proud of, my children were, had the good fortune, my son's working with me this session, had the good fortune of growing up with him and considering him a grandfather, and my daughter, when she was 8 or so, I'd talk to her on the phone, she'd say, how's the silver fox? And we vacationed together, and I was very proud in terms of civil rights. In his first 3 terms, he represented a triple member district in the East Central side, which includes Albina, and he was extremely popular in that area, and even when he moved out the east side, the entire community continued to support him when the single member district required that. And in 1948, at the Republican National Convention, there was a black African American member in their delegation, and he led a boycott of the activities. They wouldn't allow that delegate to ride the same elevator or ride the same transportation, and he led a walkout in those days. And in 1952, Republican National Convention, the Oregonian and the Oregon Journal, both had a reporter, full-time reporter and full-time photographer following him throughout the convention, and both did full picture pages on his activities. He was far ahead of anybody at that time, including Mark Hatfield, but chose not to run for public office until 1966 because of family concerns. And at the time when he ran for the first time, he was a newcomer running, a Republican running against a 5-term Democrat, and he beat him in a manner, overwhelmingly beat him in a manner that the person supported him for re-election the next time. And at the same time that he was running for the state house for the first time, he was also the statewide chair of McCall's first campaign for governor, and spent half his time traveling the state putting that campaign together and keeping it together, and which running for one seat is usually enough for most people, but running a statewide campaign and your own campaign at the same time is a bit of a challenge, plus selling life insurance. But a person that I am very proud of, very happy to have had the chance to share part of his life and to see the various groups that he impacted in a very, very positive way. And I'm thankful that this committee and this body will take the time to remember those that gave so much. I think it's important that we do that.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's an honor to be here to talk about the life and accomplishments of Robert A., as the Senator has noted, as his wife called him. I knew him after his legislative career as a very active leader in his church, where for many, many years, almost until his death, he ran the church Sunday school, not only for the children of his parish, our parish, but also for the children of all other churches that wanted to participate. He had a very inclusive philosophy, as you've heard, and that extended to his church service, too. Let me close by thanking you for honoring Robert Elliott's memory. He was truly an outstanding individual and a man for all seasons.
Thank you.
Sure, may I add one thing? I know it's late, but Robert A. And Thelma were really a team, and probably we should be doing a resolution for Thelma, too. She was on the David Douglas School Board for many years and then was on the State Board of Education for 8 years. And Thelma loved budgets, absolutely loved budgets. In fact, for Christmas, they both passed away within a year, but the Christmas before last, Robert A. gave her a copy of the state budget, all gift-wrapped. And, you know, she was absolutely thrilled. I mean, she was really thrilled, and most people didn't understand that, but if you knew Thelma very well, you could understand it very well. I spoke at her funeral in January, and I commented that I knew where Thelma was going. There was no doubt in my mind where she was going, and that God probably thought he's in charge up there, but wait until his first budget hearing. I can assure him it will be a different experience. Thelma was constantly in a state board meeting. She'd say, you know, I woke up at 3 o'clock this morning and was reading the budget, and how I so often wished I could have given her sleeping pill. Great, great person.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again for your time.
Thank you. Close the public hearing. Open the work session on HCR 6.
Mr. Chair, I would move HCR 6 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Byers moved HCR 6 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Byers.
Aye.
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 Is
HSR.
Aye. Item C, the necessary majority, HTR 6, move to the floor with the due pass, and Senator Duncan will carry. We've closed the work session, HTR 6. We're going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1312. Invite Jennifer Norick, Tracy Fry, and Dr. Sue Ann Smith. I believe Dr. Smith has a slide presentation. Which will help us to understand a bit about what this bill is all about.
Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Sue Ann Smith. My voice is very low, so if I need to speak up, tell me. I am a neonatologist, which means I'm a physician specializing in the care of sick and preterm infants. I am currently employed at the Dornbecker Neonatal Care Center. Today, however, I'm giving this presentation in a professional and human capacity. What I'm presenting does not represent the position of Oregon Health Sciences University or the opinions of Dornbecker Children's Hospital, etc. I have come to this hearing to provide a quick educational presentation on a type of birth trauma called subgaleal hematoma and help, hopefully, to provide a perspective of why these families are here with this bill today. And I usually give an hour presentation on this, so, and I usually give it to medical personnel. So if you don't understand something and if I go too fast, please bear with me. The first thing I wanted to do was to give you an idea of what a subgaleal hematoma is. As I said, it's a form of birth trauma involving the scalp. It's a hematoma under the layer called the galea aponeurotica. That's the part of the scalp that allows it to go be mobile on the skull. I'm going to show a few slides here. Let me do say that some of these slides are not for the squeamish. So if anybody's squeamish, they might want to leave the room.
And hear me, I guess I don't have a pointer, so I'll do it with my fingers. Is there fingers available? Okay. The main thing I wanted to illustrate in this slide was the anatomy of the scalp, and that the hematoma that we're talking about occurs underneath the layer of the scalp and above the skull. That occurs into a space that is driven only by the brow and half of the neck. The whole area is encompassing the subgaleal space. Once the baby starts bleeding into the space, they can move their entire blood volume into that space. This is a CT scan of a baby with a subgaleal hematoma. And what I wanted to point out was this very dark white area is the baby's skull. This is the edge of the scalp. Everything in between there is in blood. Next, I'm going to be showing just a quick view of medical babies with this condition. This is baby Elizabeth with the subgaleal hematoma. The another view of the image that you can see the way her head is very full of the blood underneath. This is baby South Moon. His mother is here today. This is baby Christopher. His mother is here today. And this is baby George. Another picture of baby Christopher.
I'm trying to make this brief. Those are the score of 18 patients that have been referred to the Dornbecker Neonatal Care Center since November 20th of 1991. Of importance is the fact that between 1977 and 1991, there were no infants admitted or referred to the Dornbecker Neonatal Care Center with this diagnosis. As I mentioned, since that time, there have been 18 babies. 13 of those babies had their delivery assisted by a device called a vacuum-assisted delivery device. That makes a 72% association. Six of those babies died. All of those babies had a vacuum used to assist in their delivery process. I have a network of colleagues within the state who I talk to on a frequent basis, and I am aware of three other babies who were not cared for at Dornbecker who have died in that period of time with this injury. You have on a handout a sort of table of looking at the Oregon births, the number of C-sections, number of forceps, and vacuum on the outline of my presentation there. And you can see that in the year, first year on that graph in 1986, only 203 babies had a vacuum in this entire state used to assist in their delivery. About the time of 1991, that number went up substantially to around 1,300 or 1,400 and has stayed about that since that time. I have been involved in many educational activities to try to educate medical practitioners regarding this problem. Amongst those activities are a medical journal article co-authored by myself and many of my colleagues at Oregon Health Sciences University that you have in your handout. Additionally, in your handout, you have an article from the New England Journal of Medicine, which I would refer you to the operative vaginal delivery section, and you have an advisory issued by the FDA on vacuum-assisted delivery devices. And again, my disclaimer. I'm going to pass the microphone over to Jennifer Nord now.
Mr. Chair, Governor. As you can see, this is a very emotional topic for me.
Give us your name, please, for the record.
My name is Jennifer Mark. I'm the one who came to the Mary Brady Adams with this bill. First of all, I'd like to thank you for hearing this today. I've never done anything like this before, and I hope you'll bear with me.
Just take your time.
I think first I'd like to start with a little bit of background about myself. I'm a 25-year-old married mom. My husband, Richard, is home at work. I have a 2-year-old daughter and couldn't make it. My husband and I met in high school and started dating my senior year. Went away to college for a year, decided to come home and get married. In 1992, we got married and decided to start our family. We tried for a year, but we were unable to get pregnant on our own, so we were sent to a doctor that could help us. I took a fertility drug called Clomid and became pregnant. We thought 1994, all of our dreams of family would come true. We had an ultrasound that told us we were going to have one baby, and the baby looked healthy, I progressed in my pregnancy without any major problems. I went to every prenatal appointment, and I continued to work until about a week before delivery, and before my 2 days. When labor started, we called ahead to the hospital, and we were told if contractions continued, to come on in. We soon left for the hospital. We're going to have our baby. I was extremely excited. Labor went slow, but I was happy that I was able to handle the labor, and I was going to be able to do it without any drugs. About 3 a.m., I started to push. It seemed like I had been pushing forever when the doctor told us that the baby was stuck at the corner, and he asked for the vacuum extractor. And this is what the vacuum extractor is. He didn't give us any explanation of any risks or possible complications. He had never heard of it before and knew nothing about it. We trusted that our doctor knew what he was doing and would do the right thing. The vacuum popped off several times, and I was told by my doctor that if it popped off during the contraction, to keep pushing and he would reattach it. At some point during this time, an obstetrician was called in to help. We were not told if there was any problems. All I knew is there was one more man in the room. We continued with the vacuum, and at one point, the OB told my doctor to use the vacuum in between contractions. After 54 minutes of use, our baby was born at 5:28 a.m. It was not all that I expected. In birthing class and in reading material, you hear how the head is born, then the nose and mouth is suction, and then the doctor asks for one more little push, and the baby is born and comes to your stomach. Well, in our case, it was far from that. 1 second, they said the head was out, and then I looked up and heard my husband say, "It's a boy." No little push, no squeeze with baby on my stomach. I saw my little baby in his doctor's arms, with his arms hanging down with no life in it. They rushed him over to the warmer, and all we heard was the nurse saying that he had a heartbeat, but he wasn't breathing. I was terrified, and my husband started to cry. And all I could think of is they were supposed to put him on my stomach. We were not told anything if he was taken from the room. A while later, a nurse came back in and said he was going to be transported to Medford for a respiratory problem. Then she left. Later, a nurse came back in to take me to a different room, and I said that I was going to get leaving with Christopher. She said that he was doing good, that they were going to cancel the transport, but they couldn't once they were called. While I was taken to another room, I told Richard to go and check on. The pediatrician that was taking care of Christopher talked to Richard and said he was going to be fine. He would be able to come home in a couple of days. He was breathing on his own and had taken the breathing tube out himself. Richard was able to see Christopher moving his arms and legs and crawling. He looked better if he was pink and moving around. By 9:30 that morning, the transport team was ready to take him. I got a quick look at him, and the transport unit was gone. We were told not to come over right away because the doctor would need time to look him over. So when Christopher was taken, we went home to wait for my family and to pack, thinking that we would stay in Medford for a couple of days, then bring him home. When we got to Medford, we had to wait for the doctor to come out and see us. But after what seemed like forever, a pneumonologist came out to see us. She told us Christopher did not have a respiratory problem. He had a bleeding head, but half of his blood volume was in the subgaleal space, and he needed to go to Portland for the best care. But a doctor there had just written a paper on a subgaleal hematoma and thought he would be better off up there. We got a quick look at him, and the first look I had really gotten at him, and to touch him for the first time. He was about 7 hours old. he's medicated, so he's not moving, and his eyes have been swollen shut from the bleeding. He took a quick couple of pictures, and he was off to the airport. I gave you one of them. It's the smaller one. We were not allowed to go with him. We did not feel safe driving since we had been up all night. So we went home to rest and waited for Portland to call. Then Dr. Smith called and told us that Christopher had a 20% chance of survival. And if he did, he would more than likely have cerebral palsy. That next morning on Monday, we left as soon as we could for Portland. We got there about 11:30 that morning, and we got to see him for the first time. And what we saw is those big pictures that he had. Then Dr. Smith took us into a room to fill us in on his condition. He asked me if I had been able to hold him. If I had been able to hold him yet, and I had not, so she arranged that for me. My son was almost 31 hours old before I got to hold him for the first time. I never got to see my son open his eyes. I was never able to see him move his arms and legs. And I never got to see him breathe on his own. But most of all, I will never get to see the healthy baby that I went into the hospital to deliver, live a full life. On December 22nd, 1994, we took him off the ventilator. He was perfect in every way, except for the damage done by the vacuum and the injury he received to his brain from being forced through my pelvis that was too small for him. When we caught his autopsy gas, all of him was perfect. The only thing wrong with him was his brain. After Christopher died, we had many questions. We received a copy of the medical records and started doing research on the vacuum. We found out that many things had gone wrong, and I feel that if we'd been given a choice and knew the dangers when things started to go bad, we would have our son with us today. Since we lost Christopher, I decided I did not want any other parents to go through what we did. At first, I didn't know where to turn. Once I was able to get in contact with other parents that had the misfortune of having a vacuum injure or kill their child, we decided that we needed to get the word out. It wasn't going to go away on its own, and together, we can make a difference. We contacted news magazines, and 2020 did our story, which aired in January. And we also wrote to the FDA. But once all that was done, we found that it wasn't enough. Babies were still being hurt or dying because of this device. And that is why I'm here today. I have a copy for you of instructions for the vacuum that was used on Christopher and have highlighted the things that were not followed in our case. I've also given you a copy of FDA Public Advisory that came out in May 1998 and lists complications such as the subgenital hematoma and lists recommendations. Some of the recommendations are the person using the vacuum be aware of the indications, contraindications, and precautions of the vacuum. That before the vacuum is used, the user should read and understand the instructions. The reason I would like to bring this to your attention is with the birth of Christopher, our doctor did not know what vacuum he was using, and the obstetrician that came in to help did not know either. Neither had read the instructions provided by the manufacturer. I feel that this is why all persons that are going to be using this device in a delivery should have to be certified by the hospital before they use it. Such things as an X-ray machine, a ventilator, or even to put in a test tube, hospital personnel has to be certified. In obstetrics, OBs and family practice doctors have to be certified to use fetal monitoring, low forceps delivery, or even to give Pitocin. But as of right now, a vacuum extractor that can take a life with a healthy baby, the user doesn't have to be certified. And it's facilities that train doctors in the vacuum. They should review their training to make sure that they are teaching these doctors to follow the instructions given to them by the manufacturer. All I have to show for Christopher's short life is a scrapbook of photos, a video of his home in Portland, and a box full of medical records. I have submitted a video of Christopher and Portland and a copy of the 2020 show that we were on with another family that had a daughter injured by the vacuum. I hope you will take the time to watch it. And to me, the most important part of this show is the informed consent. In the hospital, patients need to give informed consent for such things as surgery, epidurals, or even to get transported to another facility. But for a device that can severely damage or kill a child, you have no way of knowing the risk unless the doctors are told that they must give informed consent. Right now, the doctors have all the control and have the information available to them, and the parents should have that information too. It is the parent's baby that is going to be affected by this device. And I would like to conclude with this question to you. Would you want an untrained individual using this device on one of your family members, or using it without telling you the risk of bleeding in the brain, skull fractures, or even death, as in our case? This is why I've come to you with this bill. I feel that the people using this device should know how to use it properly, be certified by a hospital to use it, and inform you of the risks instead of letting them decide for you. Thank you.
Questions?
It sounds like, it sounds like your doctor or doctors have made a mistake and should have been C-section. When you became aware of this, did you pursue legal remedies against them?
Yes, we did.
In the form of malpractice?
Wrongful death.
And in that, did you also join the hospital?
No, we did not go after the hospital.
Just the physician?
Yes.
Thank you.
Senator Brown.
I actually have two questions for the doctor. Are there other states that have statutes requiring specific training requirements or specific consent procedures for this particular procedure that you're aware of?
No, I'm not aware of the laws regarding this in any states.
Okay.
Another question.
I assume in some of these cases, and I have not personally been through delivery and don't have a lot of experience here, but I'm assuming that the other option is to use forceps. And are there risks involved in using forceps as well? It obviously sounds like in her case a C-section was appropriate, but...
Well, I'm a neonatologist, first of all. I don't perform any of these procedures, and I don't really feel qualified to answer that.
Thank you. Do you have testimony for us?
A little. My name is Tracy Fry, and
you pull the microphone over a little closer.
We had our baby in November of 91, and it was our first baby, first pregnancy. Everything was going just well. My story is very similar to Jennifer and Richard. And our daughter Chelsea was, we were the first reported case that this happened to. And I just think that with all of the studies and things that Dr. Sue Ann Smith has been doing and going around trying to educate doctors, that this bill would be a very positive move. It's very simple, you know. Us as parents, we have rights to know what is going to be, the procedures are going to be formed on our baby. You know, it's, doctors are, you know, here to save lives. And for this bill to pass, we would be able to, you know, be able to say, yes, we want this procedure done, and no, we don't, and to know, you know, that it is going to hurt our baby if, you know, I would have loved the doctor to tell us that, you know, this could, this suction could have a subgenital hematoma and could kill your baby. You know, I would have loved for him to say that, but he didn't. And I would have had a C-section versus a vacuum extraction. So I think that we should, you know, I hope that this goes forth, and I hope that we can get the word out.
Thank you very much. I believe we have any further questions. We'll have other witnesses. Dr. Nichols, we've got the
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. With me today is Dr. Mark Nichols, who will address the legislation. I have also previously given all of the committee members correspondence from Dr. Paul Kirk as well, who is an OB-GYN, and I'll wait for questions after Dr. Nichols' testimony, if you think so.
Very much.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'll make my comments brief. I know the time is short. My name is Dr. Mark Nichols. I'm an associate professor in OBGYN at OHSU and also the vice chair of the Oregon section of the American College of OBGYN, or ACOG. I'm testifying today on behalf of the OMA, and I need to also add the disclaimer that the comments I'm about to express are not shared necessarily by the OHSU or its board or any other employees. I'm testifying in opposition to this bill. Vacuum extractors are useful instruments for managing some uncommon complications of labor. When used appropriately by well-trained providers in the proper setting, they are safe instruments for aiding the delivery of babies. Over the last several decades, the incidence of birth trauma has been reduced significantly to a very low number, perhaps to the lowest attainable incidence. And this is to no way minimize the tragedy that we've heard about or that does occur. Concerns around the safety of the vacuum device have been recently raised. The medical community is responding to these concerns, and I believe there is no need for this legislation. Mechanisms already exist so that physicians are trained and updated about the use of these medical devices, such as the vacuum extractor. Residency programs are monitored by the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education to assure that the education is to assure thorough education of physicians. I do train residents in obstetrics at OHSU. They are well informed about the proper indications and technique and precautions of using vacuum extractors by the end of their training. After training, additional mechanisms exist to inform physicians and modify their practice. Hospital and medical staff organizations are required to only grant privileges for performing vacuum extractions to physicians who have had adequate training and experience in this technique. The FDA continuously updates physicians about concerns around new devices or drugs. In May of 1998, the health advisory that's been previously described was issued, and I believe you have it in front of you. Professional organizations such as ACOG provide ongoing review of advances of medicine and advise the physician community about new information. ACOG produced a committee opinion in September of 1998, which advised obstetric care providers of the advisory. Community hospitals have also emphasized to their staff about the recent advisories. For these reasons, I believe the goals of Section 21A and B are already being met. I do have concerns about Section 3 of this bill. There are already well-established standards of practice in medicine requiring physicians to obtain informed consent prior to initiating any operation. This is called the PAR conference, and this includes informing the patient of the details of the procedure, the alternatives, and the risks of the operation. It is not reasonable to require this process at a time remote from the operation. Fine details of the particular clinical setting where a vacuum extractor might be used are impossible to know in advance of labor. In addition, it is very common for the person providing prenatal care to not be the person delivering the baby. In my own case, I would not feel comfortable performing an operation without personally obtaining informed consent from the patient. This legislation will interject administrative rules between my patients and me, and in certain circumstances, it would eliminate one option for delivery. The Oregon Medical Association is committed to improving the quality of obstetric care in the state. I share with the authors of this bill the goal of reducing obstetric trauma in Oregon. Though admirable, I don't believe this legislation will achieve these goals. Thanks very much.
Questions?
Senator Byatt.
The statistics that were provided by Dr. indicate about 3% of the Oregon birth currently use the vaccine. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And I believe the testimony was approximately 18 babies who died as a result of that or suffered a severe injury. Looking at that, I presume then that the others were successfully done. My question is, given the testimony from Mrs. Norrick, would you say that her doctor in that particular case followed the correct procedures that you just outlined?
Well, I think that question points out the difficult nature of these clinical situations, because the exact details of the physical examination, labor, the condition of the baby are very difficult to know unless you're there personally. And it's a judgment call requiring knowledge and wisdom of the healthcare provider to make the best decision. I can say that in labors where there has been lack of progress or a need to do what's called an operative delivery, something other than the mother pushing the baby out, that there are choices that need to be made between use of a vacuum extractor, forceps, or a C-section, and that falls to the judgment of the healthcare provider discuss that with the patient, do a PAR conference, describe the alternatives, and once obtaining informed consent from the patient, then proceeding.
Sure. And follow up. Then under current protocols or PARQ processes, the doctor should obtain informed consent before using the vaccine?
Yes, that would be true for all operations, including vaccine extractors.
Dr. Nicholson, at what point in the delivery process would the physician go through the PAR process?
Because the need to do an operative delivery is not universal in labor, we hope that things will go well. When there's a problem in the course of labor, then we have the discussion about that particular situation. Every labor is different, and unless you're there knowing what the course has been, doing a physical examination of the mother and baby, knowing the size of the baby, how much force would be needed, all these go into the decision about what to recommend. So I don't think it's possible to really be able to truly inform the patient about the process unless you know the details of what's happening at that time.
Let me see if I understand then. I assume you would talk to the patient about the normal delivery in sort of some general terms at some point during the process of the delivery. Problem arises, and at that point you would say to the patient, this is not going the way it needs to do. We need to make a decision, and then describe what you're recommending and ask for informed consent.
And talk about the alternatives, and in this case it would be forceps, vacuum extractor, or cesarean section.
Right. And normally the normal protocol would be that all of those options would be described?
Yeah. But
I've made a delivery of three of my own, and I'm not sure my wife would be in a position to make that decision.
Well, that's a good point. I think that labor is a stressful time, and obstetric care providers need to consider that when they're informing patients about the alternatives and trying to make the best decision.
Obviously, at the point when someone is going to use either the vacuum extractor or the forceps, there's a problem.
Yes. Yes.
So you're more or less in a crisis mode of trying to resolve that?
The crisis may be that may be acute. The baby may get suddenly in trouble and they may need to move quickly. But the other end of the spectrum would be a progress in labor that just has not gone well through exhaustion or some other factor, so it's not as emergent.
Generally, from the medical practices, the vacuum extractor, we're sort of looking at three different, maybe more, but three different choices here. Is the vacuum extractor considered to be the easiest or the safest?
I don't think I can really say. I mean, there are pros and cons to each of those three options. All of them require training and skill and proper technique, but I can't say that in general terms which is safest or better. It really depends on that particular situation.
I have to say I'm a little bit surprised in the description that we had. I sat on the board of a small hospital. I know they go through the exhaustive process to go through the certifying that whether we grant the right to practice, and I know that there's some exhaustive procedures that they have to go through with medical professionals and others before they can do it. It sounds like in this case, described in what's asking here, that they be certified on the use of equipment. My experience has been, is that sort of standard?
Well, we believe that the granting of privileges by hospital in obstetric care includes an assessment whether or not the provider is skilled in performing vacuum extractions, and that's a requirement of residency training to make sure that they are well trained. And then the hospital boards will decide about granting privileges.
Are there significant differences in the type of equipment the vacuum extractors? I noticed in just looking at the FDA notice that they talked about familiarity with the particular.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there are several different brands and types of vacuum extractors.
And if you were, as a physician, if you were familiar with one, if you went into, I suppose if you were in a hospital where you've been granted privilege, you should probably be aware of the equipment that they were using there.
I would hope so.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, you would also have, obviously, and again, this is a very tragic circumstance, and let me say that on the record, but if there is an adverse event, physicians who are involved in those, and it's not just limited to, obviously, this particular area, there are reviews through the hospital systems, peer review, et cetera, to make determinations of why that has occurred in the process. So, you know, there are also processes after an unfortunate event to review what has occurred, why it has occurred, involving the physicians, you know, in that process as well, which is most certainly appropriate. Again, to try to reduce the number of adverse events that might occur in any kind of surgical event that might be pulled in the facility. So.
Senator Brown.
I have two questions you might have answered or answered one of these in the other room, and that is, are there other states that provide specific regulations or statutes regarding this particular procedure that you're aware of?
I'm not aware of any.
Okay. Okay. Mr. Chairman, one more follow-up.
Yes.
I'm just curious, and it's probably totally off base, but since you're here, the C-section rate has gone down fairly substantially over the last 10 years. Why is that?
I think that's partly because of education around physicians in vaginal birth after cesarean section. It used to be said that once a cesarean section was performed, all subsequent deliveries needed to be by cesarean. That's now changed. We are doing a lot of those second deliveries vaginally. There's also pressure from insurance companies and hospitals to reduce the C-section rate because of the cost. So physicians are placed in a somewhat difficult situation. I will emphasize, though, that these decisions about operative deliveries are made through this informed consent care process, and we try to focus, of course, on the optimum outcome rather than the hospital board's bottom line.
Thank you.
Thank you. The protocol that you've described to us doesn't seem to be that different from what we're asking in the bill. Is it substantially different?
The main difference in my mind is the expectation that conference would occur prior to the onset of labor. Labor can last a long time. The person providing the prenatal care may not be the same person doing the delivery. A physician cannot know the exact details of the problem in advance. It's just not possible to know. You can speak in general terms about passing extractors, but I would not feel comfortable having had my colleague, even Dr. Kirk, who submitted a letter, if he obtained consent for a vacuum extractor on one of his patients and I was on call to deliver her, I wouldn't accept that. I just wouldn't. I would need to do it myself.
Okay.
I'm going to follow up on this.
Okay. If the timing of the informed consent were changed in the bill?
I would see it as redundant because this is the expectation of all operations.
I guess I understand why you would see it as redundant. I see it as accepting our responsibility for protection of consumers and not as some kind of infliction on the medical profession. But I understand what you're saying, and I understand who, as a father of four sons, that they're each different in the delivery. So, Senator Brown.
Follow up on your question. You admitted earlier that the birthing time was fairly stressful, and it sounds to me like doctors don't regularly go through the C-section forceps vacuum extraction delivery, I always call them options or methods, prior to the child's arrival, and I guess wouldn't it make sense for that to happen ahead of time so folks at least have an understanding as opposed to when they're having a baby?
Yeah, that's a fair observation. I think that the knowledge that women have before starting in labor comes from many sources, and that all prenatal care providers try to educate their patients about the possible events that could occur in labor. But they also get information from books, from videotapes, from neighbors and mothers and other sources. So I do think that the details of managing a problem in labor and performing an operation and going through this informed consent process needs to occur at that time. As this information from the FDA has come out, I think women and physicians are obviously aware of the concerns and more cautious already about the use of vacuum extractors. I think that the concern has been raised. There is awareness of it. I see women in these situations now who have said, You know, I've heard about this vacuum extractor, and I don't want to have a delivery that way. I want forceps. That's a completely different story than what we heard 10 years ago. So, you know, the word has gotten out to consumers, to physicians, and I believe the legislation would do nothing to improve or add to that.
Dr. Nichols, I don't remember this, and I guess it's the Professional Association of OBGYNs. Is there sort of, and most of them have some standards and sort of protocols or suggestion, is it generally accepted in practice that the physician would at some point during the pre-delivery process, I'm thinking more towards the early part of the pregnancy, that would sort of describe the kinds of things that would happen in the delivery and what might come up and go through this kind of thing?
That's an excellent question. Now, I don't have those documents in front of me. I can tell you that the American College of OBGYN does expect, there is the expectation and standard that patients are to be educated informed about what will happen in labor. I cannot cite line and verse in terms of the details of that, but in general terms, this professional organization and most others support the notion that patients be informed about what is going to happen to them.
And generally, do they encourage physicians to cover these kinds of things, the vacuum extractor and C-sections?
I think that all possible, you know, general topics are expected to be covered as part of the educational process. But that's very different than saying, okay, we're going to do an operation.
I understand that. Yeah. I understand that. It's a hard time, though, when you're there. At least my observation from my 3 kids, that's a very tough time to be trying to explain a procedure to somebody.
I agree. It is hard. And it requires good judgment on the part of the obstetric deliverer. But that obstetric provider, that's been going on for a long, long time. That's not going to be any different now or 10 years in the future or 10 years ago.
I'm sort of here trying to remember back. It's been a long time since my youngest was born. But I remember going through those processes and the classes, and it seems like you're inundated with it, and frankly, kind of glad you're really concerned. But there's a lot of information. I remember the discussion over C-sections and those kinds of things. I don't ever remember a discussion over vacuum extraction.
And you can see the number is really
mighty vacuum where this would start.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, 3
other witnesses, I believe. Matt Stevenson, come on up, and I will invite Jerry Hammer from Marion County, and Sherry Dave. Come on up.
Would you like to go first?
Would you go first, sir?
Chair Starr, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Graham Higginson. I'm the State Health Officer and Deputy Administrator for the Oregon Health Division, and this bill directs the Health Division to adopt rules relating to the use of vacuum extractors and directs physicians and surgeons to obtain informed consent, as you've already had a discussion about. I did want to provide you just with some very rough statistics that I asked to be pulled together today on the Oregon experience. In 1998, approximately 8% of deliveries utilized instrumentation. About 80% or 6.5% were vacuum extracting, and about 1.5% were using forceps. As you've already heard from people, there are established guidelines for the use of vacuum extractors as well as forceps. And I think, as you've already heard, both the FDA and the OBGYN professional organizations have come out with recommendations about when to use them and that these should be used cautiously. And I think that all of us would agree that there is an issue here and something that we would like to see improved, because I think we're all working towards improving health outcomes. And the Health Division does that in a number of ways. And unfortunately, however, you cannot legislate good clinical judgment. And the question we have is not whether or not we should be doing something, but what is the most effective way to do something. around this issue. And given that guidelines already exist, we're questioning whether or not using a regulatory approach is the way I read this bill is the most effective means, which would be really focus our energies and our resources on better education and training. And with that, I'll end the testimony and be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you, Brian.
This requires you to certify all users of vacuum extractors are qualified. And then I guess somehow it would be involved in verifying the training method. How would you accomplish that?
CureStar, Senator Bryant, as I read the bill, what we would be responsible for is making sure that hospitals themselves were doing that certification process. So we would set up rules that said that hospitals would have to set up a certification process, and then we would have to have a monitoring scheme to go out and check to make sure that indeed certification was taking place and everyone that was using a vacuum extractor was certified. And then similarly, when the hospitals are setting up their training programs, we would have to have some kind of standards and guidelines to make sure that what that training program was getting across for the items that are listed in the bill, basically, that they were following the manufacturer's instructions.
Further questions?
Do those certification and training standards exist now that would be readily adoptable?
Chair Star, Senator Bryant, are you asking for vacuum extractors, those certification? And to the best of my knowledge, they don't. And I'm not certain that that would be a terribly difficult thing since, as you've already heard, the manufacturers already have, you know, a proper use of the equipment guidelines, and the Academy of Obstetrics and Gynecology already has standards for when the use of instrumentation is appropriate. So I don't think it would be a terribly difficult thing to do, but they don't exist now.
Any further questions? Please, continue. For the record.
My name is Jerry Hemmer, Senator Starr, representative. My daughter gave birth to my first grandchild in the Salem Hospital on October 16, 1997. She did die 6 hours later as a result of a subgeolar hemorrhage. My daughter at that time was a senior at Western Oregon University. She was very careful during her pregnancy, also during the time of delivery. She was pushing for 2.5 hours. At the time that the baby was supposed to be emerging, she didn't move any further. And at that time, the doctor came in and said that he wanted to use the VAC system. We asked, what is the VAC system? Will it cause any harm to the baby? He said, no, it won't do anything. It'll just cause a little banana shape on the head and a bruise on the top of the head, and it'll go away in time. And I remember saying to him that he couldn't even tell what direction the head was facing because he couldn't get his finger under the bone or around the top of the head. And I kept thinking, how could that be? How could you squeeze something through there without any trauma? If I was helping her with pushing, I was less than a foot away from the baby when she was delivered. She had a bowel movement before she was born, so it was very vital at that point to suction out her lungs before she took her first breath. He used the back, and there wasn't any of the trauma that Jennifer described for you. But when she came through, the doctor wasn't ready to vacuum her airway out, so he let the head go back in and pulled her out again and used the top of the VAC system as a handle. And as I understand it from reading the directions, the nurse had no way of knowing of how much pressure was going through the tube to the baby, and he held the head up and suctioned her mouth. I could tell at that time that there was a very significant problem with the baby. When the doctor lifted the baby into his arms, she was not breathing, and she had a very faint heartbeat. They took her over. Everyone else heard that it was a girl.
I waited for that first breath that never came. They massaged her heart. Very quickly took her out of the room. The doctor had no idea of what was happening. He talked to my daughter about it. Maybe it was some kind of infection. They didn't know that they would check that out. And I remember walking back and forth while he was taking care of her, not knowing how to address my daughter, who I was telling all through labor. She was in labor from Monday to the baby was born on Thursday. That was a long time. She would not have been able to give informed consent at that time and knew what she was agreeing to. Even with me in the room and her husband and her mother-in-law, we were not informed of anything that could happen to that baby other than a banana-shaped head. Every baby book that they hand out talks about nothing about the VAC system or the dangers of the VAC system. There's nothing there. So as far as what today's age, you have these kids that are being more and more informed and want the information. They're taking care of themselves, and you see healthier parents, and you have couples. I think they should have the right to decide whether they want a VAC system used or not. My granddaughter passed away in 6 hours, and my daughter never had the opportunity to hold her. Not once. And she told me to tell you that if there was anything that she would want to have happen from this is informed consent, it would have changed her life. Because she would not have allowed them to use that system. As far as the doctor's training is concerned, Jamie is pregnant again, and she's 4 months along, and she is now living in Denver, and they have not ever heard of it. So the federal guidelines are not working. It's not enough. And if you feel like this is too regulatory, I would suggest that you go ahead and put it forward. At least you can sunset it, and after everyone hears about it, maybe in 2 sessions. And the word needs to get out. People don't know. My daughter has told her friend. She had a friend who worked with her with having twins. They were going to use the VAC system to bring out the second baby, and because she knew of what happened to my daughter's baby, she didn't allow them to do that. And I believe that you should give mothers the choice. They need to know.
Thank you. My name is Sherry Dade, and I'm the mother of Jennifer Norick. I'm also an RN. And I'd like to commend Dr. Nichols if, in fact, he is giving informed consent to his patients, and he is doing PAR conferences and informing them. I do believe that Oregon Health Sciences is working hard to instruct their interns, but unfortunately all the family practice physicians and obstetricians in the state of Oregon do not come through Oregon Health Sciences program. At my facility just yesterday, I verified with our medical staff office if in fact anyone credentialed in delivering infants in our facility had to be credentialed in the use of a vacuum extraction, and the answer was clearly no. So the information is not out there, and facilities are not making that part of the credentialing process. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, Dr. Higginson, you from the health division, did you establish any standards at all for credentialing in hospitals?
Sure, sir. Senator Beyer, we're responsible for we're responsible for licensing hospitals in Oregon, and one of the requirements of a hospital to be licensed is that they do have to have that credentialing system in place. But as to actually setting the standards for that, we do not. But that is something that is done by hospital by hospital basis.
Does that come through the, I'm forgetting the name of the are we doing an organization, a national one?
The Joint Association for the Accreditation of Hospitals. I do believe that they have those standards.
Do you happen to know?
Chair Starr and Senator Beyer, I would have to look into that and get those to you if you're interested in more information on that.
Thank you very much. I'm not going to go on a work session today, but I would like to have further discussion with Dr. Higginson about the possibility of modifying this approach some way or doing something that's not statutorial, but I'm very, very sensitive to the concerns that are brought to us today. These tragedies should never have happened, but they have, and we need to do something to make sure that they're mitigated or that there's no further tragedies such as this are happening. We've gone beyond my time limit. Our office is going to be unhappy with a couple of senators, I know.
I would have blamed you.
That's all right. But this was important, and I appreciate all of you staying here and taking the time, and I appreciate the level of the testimony. I know how tough it is, even without the emotional aspect, to come and talk to us here. We're so imposing, but I do congratulate you for bringing to us a very important issue. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing, and I'm going to set over the bill that we have remaining, and we will HCR 9 set over until our Thursday meeting. With that, I'm going to close the